Filing for bankruptcy can save a company, but it's an onerous and unpredictable process. That's why Neil wrote his book, How to Avoid Corporate Bankruptcy and Still Get the Benefits Without the Expense, Lawyers, and Oversight. In there, he covers the informal plan that he has used over 20 times to help companies that were in trouble. Look for it on Amazon, or by following the link in the show notes below, or just reach out to him directly by calling 940-808-9451. You are listening to Corporate Bankruptcy A to Z, a show designed to educate you on the ins and outs and the do's and don'ts of corporate bankruptcy. On this show, you will hear experts from every step of the bankruptcy process answer the questions you will need to know, from the simple to the complex. Your show host is Neil Goldstein, a.k.a. The Workout Guy, a chief restructuring officer who has spent the last 25 years helping over 75 clients take on the bankruptcy process. Alongside him is co-host and legal expert Stephen Raven of Saul Ewing Arnstein & Lear Law Firm. He's a bankruptcy lawyer with over 40 years legal experience under his belt. Take it away, Neil.
This product failure is a head-scratcher. Would you eat a product that had no calories or taste? Well, R.J. Reynolds thought in 1988 that some might want a smokeless cigarette. Their idea was to offer a safer way to use a cigarette with no smoke or burn. The trade-off was a widely reported unpleasant chemical taste, smelling like burning plastic to some. The product was pulled within a year and cost RJ about $1 billion. Next bad product. One might understand if McDonald's serves a chicken sandwich along with its famous hamburgers. Car manufacturers offer different models, colors, and options. These variations stay within their area of expertise. How about Colgate, the toothpaste company, offering pre-prepared frozen meals in 1982? They even had the chutzpah to include their logo on packages. I don't know about you, but my first thought was to assume each meal tasted like their toothpaste. This is our last episode in the series, and the company is well on its way to a successful exit from the bankruptcy process. With the finish line so close, you will want to listen and understand how to operate in a bankruptcy. Do's and don'ts, reports, vendor relations, personal guarantees, and much more. We sincerely thank you for your support and patience while we try to get as much of the important information about bankruptcy to you in a simple manner. We hope we were successful and will continue to be available for your questions. Keep sending them. Again, many thanks for taking the ride with us. Sir Isaac, I believe you said we had an interesting question from a listener.
All right, Neil, this question comes from Lewis in San Diego. My company filed for bankruptcy and operations have been less than expected. Any advice on what I can do to get my plan confirmed?
Lewis, your situation is not uncommon. A bankruptcy filing often causes companies to lose revenue and cash flow. During the period between the filing and the confirmation, try to offer discounts on products and services to raise cash. Also, add capital to bolster cash, making the plan offering more acceptable. Marcus, welcome to the podcast, and tell us something about you and your firm.
My name is Marcus Helt, and I'm a 22-year bankruptcy lawyer. I'm a partner at the law firm of McDermott, Will & Emery. McDermott, Will & Emery has offices all over the world, and we handle clients from the middle market all the way up into the major markets, large-scale clients.
Before we start, I would like to discuss corporate bylaws and other documents that could lead to a bankruptcy. I was in a case where Marcus was the receiver, where the corporate bylaws were not clear or done correctly. My partner and I had a dispute, and one of the options offered to me, because we couldn't resolve company issues, was a bankruptcy. Marcus, can you discuss how important corporate bylaws are in a company and how they could lead to a detrimental situation and maybe even a bankruptcy?
So corporate bylaws actually govern how the company is going to govern itself. And you see problems when there's a 50-50 split in the ownership structure. And the managers of the company, either through a board of managers when there's an LLC or a board of directors when there's a corporation, have equal votes, but there's no tie vote. There's no tie-breaking vote. So the company itself becomes paralyzed because you have one manager slash director that wants to go in one direction, and the other manager slash director wants to go in the other direction. But nobody has the tie-breaking, nobody has the control, the majority position to actually dictate in which direction the company should go. That becomes a problem when you want to make major decisions, such as a filing of a bankruptcy, or maybe a sale of the company, or maybe a wind down of the company. Receiverships become in play at that point because a receiver is someone who takes over management. Generally speaking, a receiver is someone who takes over management of the company and can dictate a path. I'm involved in a case right now where the company is solvent and the equity holders can't get along. And there was a concern by each equity holder's counsel that that disagreement will erode or destroy value. So they actually asked me if I would be the sort of tie break, the receiver that runs this company to some conclusion.
So what would you recommend for a company in that situation? Is it always going for a receiver, or is there another plan the company could implement?
The way I see it, there are three different possibilities. One is a receiver, one is a bankruptcy, but a less intrusive, less expensive way also is to just rework the governance provisions. And if you want, you can populate your board with a neutral third party. To do that, though, you got to make sure that the independent fiduciary, is what we would call it, is properly compensated for the risk. So usually that means some monthly stipend and a prepaid insurance policy. And then you could do that, do all that through a court proceeding if you need to give them even more protection.
Marcus, you get the last episode, the conclusion of a successful bankruptcy filing. The company has been operating successfully in bankruptcy and is ready to present a plan to the court. While operating in the exclusivity period, how does a company know if it's the right time to file their plan to the court for approval?
You know, usually through communications with the creditor body, looking at the visibility that's given by the company's performance relative to the projections, what your cash position is, and when your exclusive period expires. Those together tell you how quickly and how much time you have left to propose your plan. Under the bankruptcy code, the debtor and only the debtor can file a Chapter 11 plan within the first 120 days of the case. Now, debtors can extend that period, and they can extend that period up to 18 months. Whether you can extend it or not is usually dictated by how much cash you have to run in the bankruptcy, because bankruptcies are expensive. Generally, you have counsels representing the company, you have counsels representing the secured lender, you have counsels representing the unsecured creditors. All three of those constituent groups get paid out of the same corpus of cash.
In addition to the counsel for each of those constituents, there are oftentimes financial advisors for each one, all of whom also get paid out of that same corpus.
That's true. And sometimes you even, especially on the larger cases, you'll even have an investment banker for the company and for the creditors committee. You have a lot of mouths to feed in the bankruptcy. And the longer you're in the bankruptcy, the more those mouths want to feed. And the more they feed, the less money or residual value is available for the true stakeholders. So the what is optimal is before you go into a bankruptcy, you already have mapped out your exit strategy. And once you go in, all you're doing is executing on it.
What is in the plan?
Well, the plan is a comprehensive and detailed agreement between the debtor and all of its creditors and stockholders. It provides a number of things, but generally it talks about how pre-petition claims are going to be treated. Are they going to be discharged or not? How those claims are going to get paid? Are they going to get paid through a conversion of debt to equity? Or are they going to receive a pot of cash? Or are they going to receive a payment stream? It talks about changes to governance going forward. Some plans are what we call liquidating plans. So those are just sales. Some plans are restructuring plans. And some plans are a combination of both.
Is there a specific period the plan must cover?
The plan addresses how the pre-bankruptcy debts were paid and how and when the bankruptcy debts are paid. So usually when you file bankruptcy, when you file bankruptcy, you have a line in the sand. All the debts that were incurred prior to the moment that you received a case number, those are called pre-bankruptcy debts. Plan addresses how those are paid. All the debts that are incurred post-filing bankruptcy are called administrative expenses. Those are generally paid as they come due during the bankruptcy case. But to the extent that there are some that are unpaid, when you get to the courthouse and ask the court to approve your plan has to address how those are going to be paid. And the bankruptcy code says, unless a holder of an administrative expense agrees otherwise, those administrative expenses have to be paid just to exit bankruptcy. So the plan covers all debts that what we would call pre the plan going effective, which is when the plan becomes a legally binding document. Until it becomes effective, it's just a proposal that the debtor put forth on how to address all of its debts.
Could the period be 1 year, 5 year, 10 years? Is there a standard or is it flexible based upon each individual bankruptcy plan?
The period is flexible. You know, 20 years ago, plans generally took longer than they take now. Lobbyists have gotten to Congress and imposed certain deadlines to make bankruptcy cases move more quickly. One reason for that is the cost of the bankruptcy. The longer it goes, generally the more expensive it is. The more expensive it is, the less residual value remains for the stakeholders. So I think the general perception is that you'd like to get your bankruptcy plan proposed and approved as fast as possible. Most plans don't get really proposed until the end of the first exclusivity period, and sometimes those are extended.
Who usually prepares the plan?
Well, during the first 120 days, unless that period is extended, it's only the debtor. And the debtor's counsel gets with the debtor's financial advisors. So usually the debtor's counsel prepares, at least the way we do it, we go into bankruptcy with our plan. We then have an executive summary prepared. Then we go to the financial advisor and say, okay, we need the financial projections that support what we think can be accomplished here. Now, it's not as linear as that because when we're developing our exit strategy, we've already worked with the financial advisor to understand, is what our concept of how we're going to restructure this company, is it actually doable using the current financial performance and the projected financial performance that we think is attainable?
What happens to the plan after it's submitted?
Once it's submitted, then the company has to file with it what is called a disclosure statement. A disclosure statement is akin to an investment prospectus. And the goal of the disclosure statement and the rule requires the disclosure statement to provide or contain information that is adequate so that a reasonable investor can look at the disclosure statement and decide whether the investor wants to accept, which means approve, or reject, which means to vote down the proposed plan. Once that disclosure statement is filed, then the court has to review it and independently determine, does it contain the information that's deemed adequate? Oftentimes, constituent groups will oppose the approval of the disclosure statement because those constituent groups have certain agendas and want language put in those documents. And once the disclosure statement is approved, then the company, the proponent, which is usually the debtor, sends the disclosure statement and the plan out to all creditors who are entitled to vote. Only those creditors whose claim, whose pre-petition debt is being, quote, impaired, which means altered under the plan, get to vote.
Our resident bankruptcy expert, Steve Raven, can help your company decide if a bankruptcy is the right choice. Send an email to sraven@sol.com or by calling 973-286-6714. Have you learned anything new about the bankruptcy process? Let us know by leaving a review, or you can reach out to Neil and Steve directly by following their links in the show notes below. Their door is always open if you have a question, and you can be sure that they will respond. Let's go back to the interview.
So the creditors and interested parties get to see the plan.
Correct.
What do they do with it?
They read it and decide how it, the plan, impacts their legal rights. And if it impacts their legal rights in a way that's acceptable to them, then they vote in favor of it. If it impacts their rights in a way that's unacceptable to them, they vote to reject it. And then they also typically file an objection to the plan.
So what the creditors get, Neil, in addition to the disclosure statement and the plan, is a ballot. And it's a one-page document, which is what the creditor fills it out and files it with the court. And in essence, they are voting on whether to accept the plan or reject the plan. And then as part of the process where the court approves the plan is in essence a tally of the votes. And there are certain levels of approval which must be attained in order for the approval to meet that particular criteria.
Should the company fear publishing too much information that might give secrets away to competitors?
It's always a concern. And that's why the standard under the bankruptcy code is just adequate. It doesn't say that you have to provide everything. It just says you have to provide the lowest level of information such that a recipient of that information can make an informed decision.
How long does the court usually take to review the submission of a plan?
A general rule of thumb is 35 days after the disclosure statement is filed, the court will usually approve or not the disclosure statements. I would say that 90% of disclosure statements get approved, maybe even more. That might be modified because certain creditors may express certain opinions that it's probably easier for the proponent of the disclosure statement to just include a qualifying language that says, Neil Goldstein asserts the following, and that resolves that objection. The debtor disagrees, but Neil asserts the following. And then usually it's another 35 days from when the disclosure statement is approved, then the plan is solicited, the vote happens, and then you go to a hearing, which is what we call a confirmation hearing. And at that hearing, the proponent of the plan has to establish through the evidence enough to satisfy, you know, generally 15 to 19 different elements under the statute.
Do you find that most of the plans in your cases are confirmed?
I think for the more experienced practitioners and the ones who who establish their exit strategy early in the case, those plans get approved.
Steve?
You know, generally speaking, the parties by that point in a bankruptcy want to get the bankruptcy over with, and they try to negotiate with each other to get to the point of alignment so that the process is a lot smoother and less adversarial to get the job done.
This goes back to the motive. If you have a party that has a pure creditor motive, then they are more likely to agree to a business deal that is probably not the best deal they could ultimately get, but it's much better than the worst deal. If you have a holder of a claim who has a non-creditor motive, it almost doesn't matter what you propose to them. They just want to destroy you.
What is the procedure allowing creditors and interested parties to make comments and have discussions about the company's plan?
One of the things about bankruptcy that is both a benefit and a burden is there's full transparency. And one element of that being a burden is competitors get a free look. Others view it as a burden because there's information that the company doesn't want to provide. And another reason for it being a burden is it's expensive. One of the benefits of full transparency is your decisions are fully vetted, and the court has the ability to make an informed decision. So creditors get a look at the debtor's financials very early on in the case, and they can monitor along and follow the company's evolution from a new debtor to a mature debtor to hopefully an exiting debtor.
Do interested parties get to submit their own plan in opposition to the company's?
No, as long as the debtor is in the what we call the exclusive periods. Once a debtor falls out of the exclusive periods, the interested parties, anybody can file a plan.
How does that process work?
Generally, what happens is a debtor in bankruptcy proposes to extend the exclusivity period, and there could be opponents to that. And those opponents then seek court intervention or permission to what we call terminate the exclusive period. And if they can show that the debtor has no hope and no prayer of proposing a plan that will ever get approved, then the court may terminate exclusivity and open the plan process up to any interested party.
So let's say there are competing plans. How does the court adjudicate which one is the best plan? Is it only on the amount of money that pays the creditors the most?
The first step is the court has to see if the plan establishes or meets every one of the statutory elements under 1129. Once that happens, the court has to approve the best plan. In determining what's best, the court should give deference to how the stakeholders voted. But the court should also decide what is quantitatively the best plan and what is qualitatively the best plan. Because what might be the highest isn't necessarily always the best. And that's where the plan, where the confirmation hearing with multiple plans gets a little shaky, because the court can only approve one plan. You can't approve two.
Is any consideration given to the fact that the principals of the company that filed for bankruptcy have been there for years and the employees are, say, loyal to them?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's a factor. That's both a positive and a negative under the certain circumstances. Bankruptcy courts like to keep jobs. They like to give companies fresh starts and restructure debts. Where they will draw the line is if the quote restructuring is illusory and is effectively pie in the sky, such that the employees are just doing it for their own benefit.
Steve, what advice do you give your clients when preparing a plan?
What I explain to my clients is that the goal is to survive and be strong into the future. Plan's got to be fair to as many of the creditor groups as possible. You have to over-disclose with respect to the disclosure statement. Do not under-disclose. And in fact, it's a requirement of a plan that it not be filed by a conversion to Chapter 7. In other words, that the company will survive. And that's really the goal.
One of the things that a client should look for is credibility is currency. And the reason to have credibility is you can do the best you can to predict what the court would do based on the law and based on your judgment that's been developed over many years. And so I think it's always a safe proposal to say, don't get greedy and propose the plan that is fairest to everyone.
I'm on a case now where the attorneys said to the principals that they have to contribute money to the company as part of the plan to maintain their ownership. Could you discuss that?
There's a rule under the bankruptcy code called the absolute priority rule. And what that says is unless you're paying people 100 cents on the dollar, you can't retain your existing equity without putting in what the case law calls, quote, new value. So what that attorney was explaining to the company or to the principals of the company is if you want to retain your equity, you need to put in, quote, new value such that there's a corollary or an exception to the absolute priority rule.
There was a discussion about how much that should be.
Yeah, I'm sure the client wanted it to be as little as possible, and the attorney wanted it to be as much as possible. And probably the right answer is somewhere in between. But one way that courts deal with that is they terminate exclusivity. And they effectively say that the equity of the company is being auctioned for, and the opening bid is what the debtor is proposing.
The company's plan is accepted. What happens next?
Then the company has to go to the hearing and show the court that all of the elements under 1129 are satisfied, one of which is the vote element. As long as all of the other elements are satisfied, the court will approve the plan, which is under bankruptcy words, confirm the plan. And usually plans have conditions to going effective, which is the conditions to that plan being a binding agreement. Once those conditions are satisfied or waived, then the plan, quote, goes effective. Once it goes effective, it's the operative document between the creditors and the debtor that decides or determines how claims are going to be paid.
Once the exit is complete, is there anything a company should be aware of?
One of the things that is oftentimes overlooked, but shouldn't be, is due process requirements of the Constitution. So if you want to bind someone to this Chapter 11 plan, you have to make sure that they have due process, which means they have to have notice of what you're trying to get them, to how you're trying to bind them. So sometimes companies overlook notice or service of the plan on these various creditors. And if certain creditors don't get due process, they don't get noticed, they're not going to be bound by your plan, which if you're restructuring could create a significant headache and sometimes a debilitating issue. Kind of like when you file a lawsuit in non-bankruptcy court, you have to serve process on the defendant. So you have to give the defendant legally sufficient notice that the defendant is being sued. Well, in bankruptcy, you have to do the same thing with the creditors to which you're trying to affect by your plan. And if you don't do it, there are rules in bankruptcy on how to do it. But if you don't follow the rules, you may not be able to hold them accountable to how you propose to bind them in the plan.
Marcus, any parting words for our listeners?
No, I would, all other than the one thing, I would, if you're contemplating bankruptcy, spend the time and the money on the front end to make sure that you hire professionals with whom you're most comfortable. So do background checks, do research, check credentials, but probably most importantly, get to know your professionals on a personal level the best you can to make sure you're comfortable that when the going gets tough, those professionals will be there for you.
Steve, any closing thoughts on this episode?
I was trying to explain to a client why he should not file bankruptcy. And what I said to him is this: in my view, Chapter 11 is like quicksand. Once you get in it, it is very difficult to get out, and cases can take twists and turns that you could not predict. It's more than just dollars and cents. There are unpredictable events which will occur that can really ruin your day in a bankruptcy. My other point is that I think of all the episodes we've done, and Marcus, this is a compliment to you, this one has been the most educational, I think, from a typical listener's perspective. Marcus, you have a good way of explaining things, very concise and understandable. So hats off.
That's why I saved him for last.
Thank you.
Marcus, this is the fun part of the episode where you get to share some highlights from one of your most interesting bankruptcy cases.
I've had a number of interesting cases. One in particular started because a principal of a company was selling fake tax credits to finance a legitimate side of the business. And when he ran out of willing participants, he loaded his Porsche up with gas cans and drove it into a concrete wall. Before he did that, he changed the key man life insurance policies to make his family beneficiaries. And so when he drove his car into a brick wall and the car turned into a fireball, his company was left with no leader and the death benefit was paid to his family. So creditors got together and put the company into an involuntary. It survived in a bankruptcy for 1 year without anything happening. A Chapter 11 trustee was appointed who then hired me. We then went and restructured the legitimate side of the business. But while doing that, we learned of the illegitimate side and all of the fake tax credits. And we started with $400 million of claims filed against that debtor, and we ended with $30 million of claims. And the $370 million we busted through the court of being participants in this tax fraud. That case lasted for 7 years. So it was a case that had many twists and turns, none of which could have been predicted, especially by my client, who was a neutral third party, who was appointed by the court to figure it out and fix it. So that's just one. I had another case where there was a business model developed by a promoter. It was working, but he stuck his hand in the cookie jar because he wanted more than one house on the beach and he wanted more than one Ferrari or more than one Lamborghini. And we ended up having to chase him down, and my client loaned $25 million on a cocktail napkin. And we ended up chasing him down and collecting a fair amount, but we had to depose him in the federal penitentiary in Los Angeles. So that was also interesting. And I have a number of, if you do this long enough, certain things happen that just make you scratch your head. Especially when there's big dollars involved, people get desperate and they do some very questionable things.
Marcus, please tell the listeners where they can reach you.
You can send me an email at mhelt@mwe.com. It's my first initial, M, my last name, H-E-L-T as in Tom, at M-W-E, McDermottWillEmery.com. My direct phone number, that's 214-210-2821.
Do you have any concerns about the bankruptcy process and how it will impact your business? Why not ask the experts? Email your questions to neil@elementarybusiness.com and to sraven@sol.com, or you can follow the links in the show notes below. Make sure you subscribe to the show so you never miss an episode, and make sure you are sharing it with those who are making these important decisions with you. New episodes air on Tuesday every other week. Corporate Bankruptcy A to Z is produced by me, Sir Isaac Smith. We would also like to give a special thanks to our show's advisor, Dan Goldstein. Thanks for listening, and be sure you come back next time to Corporate Bankruptcy A to Z. Axelby is a full-service software development agency who loves to dig into your project and deliver the perfect software for your business. Let us put our years of experience as business executives and expert software development to work to make your project a big success. Get started by calling 469-226-6061 or by emailing dan@axelby.com. That's dan@axelby.com. And together we'll figure out whether Axelby fits into your project. Want more content? Then head over to Patreon and become a member. On Patreon, we are working on a catalog of bonus episodes, and you can hear the answers to your questions from a business perspective instead of just a legal one. If you want more direct access to Neil and Steve, or want to supplement the education you are already getting here, then follow the links in the show notes below and become a patron today. Bonus episodes will include MCA-type loans, answers to most common questions, lenders roundtable, debtors in possession loans, and bankruptcy from the chief restructuring officer's chair. Thanks for listening, and we hope to see you over there on Corporate Bankruptcy A to Z.